Okay, today is December the 16th, 2005, and I'm talking to John Wiley about his early involvement in the electron microprobe lab in the Department of Geology and Geophysics. Do you remember how you came about to use the electron microprobe?
Sure. My thesis involved working with a semiconductor called mercury-cadmium telluride. This is a mixed crystal that can have any composition between pure mercury telluride on one extreme and pure cadmium telluride on the other end. So it always is 50% tellurium, but the mercury and cadmium content varies from 0 to 1 and 1 to 0 respectively. And I got samples of mercury cadmium telluride with approximate compositions from Lincoln Labs at MIT, where they were growing crystals of it, and also from Honeywell Corporation in Minneapolis. And I think they measured the composition of the samples they sent me by measuring the density, which is very inaccurate and or very approximate. And I really wanted to know the compositions as accurately as possible. So when I found out that geology had an electron microprobe, which, as I recall, was a relatively newly developed instrument in those days, I went over and talked to Everett and asked if it would be possible to use the microprobe to determine the mercury and cadmium content accurately in these samples. And he said, sure, it would be possible in principle, but that the analysis software for making all of the necessary corrections was pretty primitive. And that I think he kind of made a deal with me that if I would help work on the data reduction software, he'd help me use the instrument and get the data. And so that's what we did. I remember I sort of took time out from my thesis work to study up on what was known about doing quantitative microprobe measurements. And reading the original literature somewhere, I developed a big file of papers that had been written on corrections for the absorption of X-rays on their way out after they've been stimulated by the electron beam. And, slowing down and absorption of the electrons on their way into the sample, and all sorts of stuff like that. There are lots of corrections. I'm trying to remember this, and you probably know it.
Well, they call it the ZAF corrections, ZAF. Yes. Back then, they probably didn't have the fluorescence very well developed.
Fluorescence was in there too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I remember coming up with some standards. I got some pure mercury telluride and some pure cadmium telluride, some pure tellurium, some pure cadmium. And mercury was a problem because it was liquid at room temperature. So I don't think I had any pure mercury samples in the vacuum. But we basically developed our own standards and wrote our own software. When it was all done, I wrote up a user's manual for the analysis package that I had developed and left it with Everett. And that's the last I ever used a microprobe, and the last I ever knew about it until he came around to talk to me a few years ago.
What was he talking to you about?
I think he was also interested in writing a history of the lab, and he wanted to interview me and jog his memory and compare our recollections.
Where was the probe located in those days?
I seem to remember that it was in a building over where Granger Hall is now. In fact, I'm sure it was. Somewhere right on University Avenue at the corner of University and Park, in one of those, in a storefront building that was attached to a Rennebaum drugstore.
That sounds, yeah, I heard it was also on University somewhere. Mm-hmm. So the corrections, so you went, I actually went and looked in your thesis, and you talked about getting some programs from somebody at the U.S. Bureau of Mines.
Bureau of Mines, yeah, I think that was it. Yeah.
In those days, the computers were, I mean, this was all punch card?
That's right. I think it was, it would have been a CDC 3600 that I used. And it was on the, I think that was the computer that was blown up when Stirling Hall was destroyed, or when Stirling Hall was bombed. It was located in the wing where the Math Research Center was, and I was just gone from campus by the time that happened, but I'm told that those fours literally dropped into the basement and the computer would have gone with them.
And the computer was in the basement?
After the bombing,
yeah.
It was.
Well, okay.
The computer was on the, I think maybe the third floor or fourth floor in the new wing of Sterling Hall, what was then a new wing.
Do you recall what year that you started doing the microprobe work?
Pretty accurately, it would have been either 65 or 66.
Okay, it had been 66 because Everett came, I think, in October of 66.
Okay, and it was 66.
Okay, so the probe was pretty new. I guess, what's his name, Gene Cameron acquired it.
Mm-hmm.
Everett had a background in X-ray studies, X-ray crystallography, mm-hmm. And had been working with some forms of electron beam instruments. So he knew a fair amount about the instrument, but I think so it sounds like you were there right when he was coming on board, and he probably knew something about the geological uses of it.
He did. He was interested in the compositions of minerals.
Right.
And I think I might have been one of his very first customers.
It sounds like it. I'm just curious now because I run the lab. I mean, did they have, was there a charge system then, or just like anybody wanted to use it was welcome?
I don't think we had to pay anything.
Yeah. Things were cheaper in those days, and today it's different. You got the service contracts, and so your samples were basically bulk samples. You weren't doing thin films,
right? Yeah, they were all about the size of your small fingernail, and they were slabs. In other words, they were polished on both sides, flat slabs, because my experiments were interferometric, microwave interferometry. And so they had to be that way.
So they were internally reflecting against the outer surfaces?
What I was doing was measuring what are called helicon waves. It's a sort of a hybrid electromagnetic and plasma wave that can exist in conductive materials in a magnetic field. So these samples went into a magnetic field with the magnetic field perpendicular to the flat surface of the sample. And then I beamed microwaves through them, and they would, some would reflect from the front surface, some would go through and reflect from the back surface. I could measure interference fringes. Analyzing those interference patterns, I could deduce the effective mass of the electrons, or in this case, it was the holes. They were P-type semiconductors. And I think the smallest effective mass ever measured experimentally it was in one of those samples. I think I set a record that stands to this day.
So that sounds awesome. So, but a hole, I mean, basically the hole is the lack, is
an absence of an electron, yeah.
Okay, so basically it's a space that they were taken up. How is that different than the space of the electron?
Well,
is it roughly order of magnitude similar?
Electrons, in a classical model or analogy, you think of electrons as being little spheres or little objects.
Right.
But really, electrons are quantum mechanical. Or in quantum mechanics, they're more diffuse. They don't occupy a specific space. So the hole is a sort of an artificial construct of a way of describing the collective motion of all of the electrons that are there. If one is missing from the valence band, then what all those other electrons that are still there do can be described more conveniently in terms of what that one missing electron spot is doing. We call that a hole.
Okay.
That, I didn't describe that very clearly, but...
No, I did.
Okay.
No, I understand some of this, and I teach some of this, and... as best I can, not having physics background. So it's motion, basically. I mean electrons are they're not masses, really. I mean, would you say an electron has a mass?
Well, sure.
It's defined as having a mass.
An electron in free space has a very accurately known mass. And electrons in semiconductors have that same mass, but because of their interactions with the atoms that are with the crystal structure, they move as if they had a different mass, and usually a smaller mass. And the how small it is determined by the energy momentum relationship in the semiconductor. The curvature of the valence band determines how low that mass is. And, the sharper the curvature, the lower the mass. So these holes in the valence band of mercury-cadmium telluride were very, very light, very small masses. The smallest one I ever measured was 0.007 electron masses. 0.0068, actually.
So again, the interest in these was for the optical properties, is that?
Yeah.
And basically, that mass of the electron translates into an energy, which translates to a wavelength of light.
Well, the interest in mercury-cadmium telluride at that time and today was to make infrared detectors. And so we were just trying to understand as much as possible about the physics of mercury-cadmium telluride as a semiconductor and how the physics changed when the composition changed. And all the samples I had were in a composition range that is where the energy band gap between the valence band and the conduction band is very, very small, in fact, theoretically zero, at one particular composition.
And one temperature, too, probably.
And one temperature, that's right, it's temperature dependent. And I had samples that were on both sides of the zero band gap composition, but it's a pretty narrow range, I had to have really accurate measurements of their compositions.
Right. So how accurate did you get with the microprobe? Or how much confidence did you have? I mean, you can get a very, very precise number.
Yeah.
And the accuracy is dependent a lot upon your standards and your procedure.
That's right. And I spent a lot of time fussing over those issues. I honestly can't remember today how accurately I thought I knew the composition, but it was probably within a couple of percent.
With matrix corrections and electron microprobe now, I mean, there's many different people have developed different correction procedures, different constants for different procedures. Did you play around with different versions of the matrix correction, or basically was there one that you had and that's the one you used? And
well, I'm trying to remember. I think we had, I remember borrowing or modifying subroutines from lots of different sources. That one program that I got from the Bureau of Mines was sort of the starting point, but then we added our own subroutines, some of which we got from other workers who were in the field, some of which we just developed ourselves. And I'm not going to remember very many details.
Sure, okay. Well, I like to see that manual. I wonder whether Everett.
He must have it.
Well, he gave me a lot of his stuff. Okay, and it's possible I didn't recognize something somewhere that I did
it
not recognize.
It was called the Probe One User's Guide or something like that.
I've been through this box a couple of times, pulling out things I can use. Something that I said, "Oh, that's old hat. I don't need that." But okay.
You said you saw a copy of my thesis.
Yeah, I went to the
library.
Yes.
Okay.
And basically, I skimmed through it quickly. But you mentioned on one page and said, "I'm not going to talk about it any further."
Oh, okay.
I'm going to look at it here. Let's see.
Oh, 5%, plus or minus 5% of the composition is all I figured we got, huh? I didn't remember that. Probe 2 user's manual, that's
okay.
What it's called.
So what was probe 1?
I don't know, it must have been an earlier version.
Maybe Everett had written one.
And, now, Dexter, it says a copy of that program is available from Richard Dexter. He was my thesis advisor. He's long since retired and moved to state of Washington, I think.
I'll check with Everett.
Yeah, I certainly would have left a copy with
him.
I don't think I have a copy anymore. If you're interested, I'll check. I've got some files at home that I haven't looked at for years.
Yeah, sure.
I might have a Probe 2 user's guide myself.
Do you remember? Okay, so this was the old, I guess it would have been called the ARL EMX microprobe.
That I don't remember.
Okay, three spectrometers manually. I mean, did you do any of the peaking of the spectrometers?
Or? No, I ever would have come over.
Okay, so he did the sort of the data collection, and you did mm-hmm. the data reduction.
I sat there with him when we were measuring them. And let's see, what can I remember about that? I remember the electron, the vacuum must not have been really great because the electron beam left visible spots on my sample.
It does, it still does.
Whether
that's no matter, I mean, the theory is that that's hydrocarbons from the backstream of pump oil mm-hmm. cracking on the surface.
Yeah,
it still is today,
unless you
have super duper clean and don't use oil or...
And sometimes I actually appeared to burn little holes in the samples. And I think that was probably because of evaporating mercury out of the
okay.
sample or something like that. But, yeah. You know, a finely focused electron beam, there's a lot of energy density,
oh, yeah.
it gets pretty hot.
Right, so what the question was the thermal conductivity. It probably
yeah.
must be not be that great for
it.
It
was pretty good, but not,
yeah.
not good.
And
enough.
Also how long you sat there, too, on, yeah. on the spot.
And we did, these crystals were grown by, as bulk crystals in sealed quartz ampules. And there was no reason to believe that they were homogeneous. So the composition could vary from place to place, a little bit at least. And I remember we did try to check that by making multiple measurements on the same sample and then averaging them.
That's probably what the 5% comes in.
Could be, yeah.
5% variation.
Yeah.
I would worry in terms of the mercury. Well, I mean, the electron microprobe analysis is nominally non-destructive, but as you inferred there with that sample, it's not necessarily true. I mean, there's
right.
certain materials that will destruct under the beam.
Sure.
And also change. I mean, electrons, you get charged deposition of electrons, you end up. People have studied looking at glass, end up, when it was oxygen or fluorine, ends up leaving the sample by mm-hmm. getting electrons from the beam.
Sure.
So
well, glass must be particularly difficult because it's non-conductive and it charges up and
deflects
the beam.
We use carbon coating, but again, that's the surface, and,
mm-hmm.
but, and you're penetrating a micron or two or three or whatever
yeah.
Into the sample. So there's still, you know, the technique's been around 40, 50 years, well, 50, no, whatever, 50. Castaing through the stuff in the early 50s, but still there's a lot of uncertainties. One of the things that's sort of a new thing on the horizon is Monte Carlo simulations,
mm-hmm.
more and more thorough ones to model what's going on in the samples, although of course it's based upon how well you understand the physics. People are doing thin films now, because I mean the probe assumes it's basically penetrating all the electrons penetrate into a certain mass, homogeneous mass of your material. Well, if you have layers of thin films, that doesn't hold.
And right.
On the other hand, if you know the physics well, you can model that. And that's one of let's say maybe half or a third of my work now is doing thin films.
Really?
So basically,
who are your customers?
Bohm Ohm.
Okay.
Engineering
faculty, for example.
Yes. Right. So it's with semiconductor. Well, I'm trying to think. Yeah. I mean, they're doing basically superconductors. Thin film superconductors, I guess it is. There's several groups in engineering, material science, that bring me over thin films. So then it's somewhat, again, software intensive, using offline programs,
mm-hmm.
running different you do the experiment with different accelerating voltage, you can affect different depths. You have a model that pretty supposedly models or basic, you know, and you develop your K ratios, your ratio of your intensity of electron of X-rays to that of the standards, and you plot up curves, and as you penetrate deeper and deeper, you can see the curves are going to change their shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
do you ever try to do non-normal incidents?
No.
Does it sort of graze them in?
But then you'd have to deal with your matrix correction, because
yeah.
then you change that parameter in terms of your takeoff angle.
Sure.
So, I think people generally think it's better to keep everything constant.
Mm-hmm.
But again, maybe in some situations you would. I've never seen a study to try to compare normal incidence versus grazing. Seems kind of dicey. I don't know. Okay.
Well, I'm afraid I don't remember a whole lot more about it than that. I will take a look at home and see if I've got anything that might be useful to you.
Okay. Great, thank you.
I've moved many times since then and dragged some of my records around, and others have been lost and so on. And of course, Dexter's lab was totally destroyed by the bomb blast. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sterling Hall bombing. Right. Yeah. That was ground zero.
So was that lab was like above it, or one or two stories above it?
The lab that I worked in was in the basement, but it had windows that went out to the parking lot, to the driveway there. And as I understand, where the truck was positioned that exploded, if I would have opened the window and reached out, I could have touched his tires. So that bomb was immediately outside the window of the lab where I did these helicon measurements. And that meant everything in the lab was completely destroyed. Right. All the mercury cadmium terahydrate samples that were on a shelf, the magnet that I did my experiment on, which was about the size of this table, was blown across the room through a concrete block wall, across the hall, through the next concrete block wall, all the way through an office, through another concrete block wall, and ended up in a hall on the other side of the building. So there is no chance that anything that was in that room was recovered. And that presumably would include the Dexter's copy of the probe to you, unless he happened to have his office saved it.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
You bet.